Accession number 8667, roll number 6.
Mr. Barton, rail 6.
We got back to the light railway and we met some Australians who, as usual, were flush with money, and they agreed to pay our fare back to Cairo. I don't know how much it was. It wasn't a lot. Anyway, we eventually get back to Cairo, and then we found Ezbekir Gardens, some very nice gardens in the middle of Cairo, where somebody told us there was a very good YMCA for soldiers. I think it was a YMCA anyway. It was a hut that was specially built for the soldiers, and where we got a very good meal. I don't think we had to pay for it, and very little anyway. And we had this meal and a drink, and I think we did it all for about 5 piastres, which wasn't much in those days. And then we eventually got the train back to our camp late at night, and that was the end of a very fine day. But now rumours began to come around again. Oh, one thing I didn't mention, and that was the arrangement of the latrines, which was something very unusual. It was right out in the desert, and the gypos had dug a very big hole, I suppose about 12 or 14 feet in circumference and about 10 or 12 feet deep, and then the carpenters, I think it was gypo carpenters, had built a covering right over it, so that it was covered, and right round the perimeter of this circular arrangement were the holes for the chaps to sit. There were no lids on, so you sat round this on this job round on this thing like a roundabout that didn't move, and no protection at all, and it must have been a peculiar sight for anybody to come along and see all these men sitting round this thing turning into the wants of nature
out in the open,
right out in the open, no covering at all, and that nothing else but the desert all round them. And
who do you mean by the gypos?
Egyptians. Yeah, from this, they're mostly Bedouin Arabs, obviously, or, the chaps with the long white shirts. And twist as they were, too. But, anyway, I can still see that place now, because I thought they would have made a wonderful picture if we could have got that, but unfortunately we never got one.
Did you have a camera with you?
I didn't have a camera, no. But one of our chaps had a small one. I don't know where he got it, but he did take one or two snaps with it, which are now very faded. But Lieutenant Barkas, he had a camera, and he took a lot of snaps. He took a lot of snaps, which are incorporated in a book, in an album which I have. You got it. Which were a wonderful record. They were chiefly of the desert round about and of Cairo, and I know there's one or two of the Australian Camel Corps in there, but he was the only one that I knew who had a camera, and because they were forbidden, and you weren't supposed to take these photographs, but he did, and I knew he took some right through there, and even when we went to when we went on the boat to France, and this should come later really, but anyway, when I was sent home at Rouen, he asked me to take the films home and take them to his to where he lived in Richmond, which I did. But I'll tell you about that a bit later, perhaps, because otherwise you're dodging the story.
You say rumours had started.
The rumours had started that we were going to France to to there were short troops in France, and that we were all going back to, all going to France. And sure enough, we did. One morning we had to pack up the camp. The camp was struck, and everything was packed up, and off we went on this blooming railway again to Alexandria, where we were again re-equipped and fresh rifles and ammunition and everything. And we eventually, there's some photographs of that actually, we were embarked on a steamer. I don't know its actual name, but it was very aptly christened HMS Starvation. Was the food situation on board was shocking. There was a tremendous quantity of mixed troops on board. Where they all came from, I don't know, but I suppose they were from various theatres of war who'd been in hospital in Alexandria, and now they were all being collected up and sent back to France.
At what point did you know where you were going?
We knew we were going to France, but we didn't know where. But anyway, when we got on board, we were told we were going to the boat was bound for Marseille, isn't it? Anyway, it was Marseilles. That wasn't a very long journey, but it was a very uncomfortable one because it was very crowded, and as I say, the food was very poor. And I'm not sure whether we could buy anything. I think we could buy a few oddments from a canteen on board, but that was about all. Well, eventually we landed at Marseilles, and we were then loaded aboard a train. Some were cattle trucks, some were luggage vans, and there was a few carriages. And you can bet your life there was a terrific rush for those carriages. I think my pals and I, we managed to get a carriage. But the others were all stuffed into luggage vans and cattle trucks, and had a very uncomfortable journey. Anyway, we steamed away, and our first stop was at Lyon. We arrived there the next morning at Lyon, and I remember that there was buckets of big barrels of water all along the platform where we could have a wash, and I think there were some French ladies who supplied tea and things like that, and also there were some other young ladies who found some postcards for us, picture postcards, which we were very glad to buy. And we wrote them out quickly and gave the girls some money for stamps and asked them to post them to our home addresses, which they agreed to do. And they did, because I know my family eventually got mine anyway. But they were the first European girls that we had seen for months and months. So, of course, we were highly excited and pleased. But I don't know there was some food issued on there, but what it was again, I think it was mostly sandwiches and things that was given to us. Well, then the next stop that I can remember was at Rouen, which was a tremendous big army camp at that time, where all the troops from coming from England went to, first of all. There were thousands in this great camp, and we were all housed in tents again. I think there were a few mess huts, but mostly tents. I think we had the meals in huts. But there again, we were given fresh clothing, and I know they tried to delouse our clothing by putting it into big steam boilers under pressure, and that was supposed to kill the lice. But I don't think anything ever killed them. And when they were reissued to us, they were all creased like something out of this world. They looked like a load of tramps. But anyway, we had some good washes and clean-ups. And we were...
Could you have hot baths?
Yes, there were some hot baths there. There was some... We were allowed to use these hot baths, but we were warned, as we'd come from the Far East and been out there for nearly a couple of years, that we were warned not to have them too hot, as our blood would be thin and it would be dangerous. What the danger was, I don't know. I suppose it might cause you to faint or something rather. But anyway, We did have some damn good washes with carbolic soap and disinfectant, and we began to feel a lot better. And of course, we could get our hair cut and things like that and have a shave, and we began to look a bit more respectable. And again, of course, we could get some polish, but I don't think we had to clean our buttons. I'm pretty sure we didn't. No, we're told not to clean our buttons because the light would reflect on them in any case if you went up and if you did happen to go, if you were ordered to the front line. And of course buttons didn't have to be clean then, but
what was the purpose in being at Rouen?
Well, at Rouen I think the majority at that time, I think most of the troops coming out there were men from Kitchener's army. I think it was about that time when the Kitchener's army had been formed, and other volunteers coming over, they were all housed there, ready to be sent up to the line. I think they were getting ready for the Second Battle of the Somme, actually. But we were re-equipped, and our little lot, about our 200 or 300, were still all together as a little unit of the 2nd First Royal Fusiliers, and we were still as that unit. And we were, each morning, we went onto the parade ground, and our NCOs used to drill us, and rifle drill and parade, and we were very, very smart, because we'd been well trained by the Marines when we were in Malta, and I don't think that these majority of the troops who were in this camp at Rouen had ever seen any drill like it. And we used to get quite a large audience, very enthusiastic, to see us do our drill. And
because you were so proficient at it.
We were very proficient at it, yes, with all the rifle drill, like you see the chaps do at the Royal Tournament. And we were only too pleased to show off. And then after we'd done this drill, we used to go for a route march for about a couple of miles. I think it was really perhaps to, because we'd been issued with new boots and had to break the boots in. But anyhow, again, we used to march off and looking very smart. And one morning when we came back, there was a general at the entrance of the camp with several staff officers on horseback watching us march in. And of course, as we marched in, we had to give the salute, eyes right, and etc. And we were marching so wonderfully well that the general said, "Bravo, men, marvellous, just like the guards come back." So we threw our chests out and thought, "Damn, we must be good." But anyway, one morning we'd done this route march and we'd got back to camp, and we just lined up ready to be dismissed, and as we came to a halt, a strange NCO came along, and I was on the right of the line, and he touched me and he said, fall out, to two or three others all along the line, fall out. And I suddenly realised he was picking out all the chaps with glasses. Usually I've been warned before when chaps were picked out with their glasses, and I managed to take mine off and put them in my pocket so that I didn't get tested. But this time it happened so suddenly that I had no warning. Consequently, I was fell out with the others, and it turned out that we were all being sent to the optician's hut to have our eyes tested. So I thought to myself, that's done that. So anyway, because I had to go to the hut and have my eyes tested, and that was hopeless, because I could only read about three lines down, even with the glasses. The optician was furious and said that the man who'd passed me for the army ought to have been shot. But there you are. He couldn't understand how I got in the army. But it's marvellous what you can do when you feel like it.
What did you tell him?
I told him that what I'd been through, and we'd been through Gallipoli and everything else, and that I'd been past A1, as it was. He got my medical sheet and I was past A1, and it was a puzzle to him. He couldn't understand it. I could have told him why. But anyway, he said, "Well, you're finished now. So that there's no more fighting for you." So, and I was marked C3, which is the lowest grade. And on my army medical history, when I joined, I was A1.
How did you feel?
Well, I felt very depressed, because it meant the end, and it meant that I should be parting from the little remnant of my battalion. But it was just as well in the end, because even that little remnant was all broken up. It was impossible to keep the battalion, to keep them as a whole or as the Royal Fusiliers, and they were split up, two or three men to this battalion, two or three men to another battalion. And I mean, they were quite broken hearted about it. I mean, I know two of them were sent to some Scottish regiment, but anywhere where a regiment was short of men, they sent these little contingents from other battalions that were, well, right under strength. But anyway, my officer, Lieutenant Barkas, he was quite upset when he heard that I was finished and had got to and couldn't stay with them. So he said, don't say you're a clerk, because if you say you're a clerk, they'll keep you here at Rouen for the rest of the duration. And I said, I don't think you want that, do you? I said, no. He said, well, say you're anything else. So I said I was a shop assistant, and consequently I got drafted back to England. So I had to say goodbye to those few who had been with me all those years. Weren't many, but those who were left, and it was rather heartbreaking, but nevertheless I was going back to England, so I suppose that was something. But while we were at Rouen, I always used to go to places of interest. The red light district never had any appeal to me. I used to like to go to other places of historical interest. And I remember one day two or three of us went to visit Rouen Cathedral, which was rather famous and had a famous tall spire. And we climbed the spire, and I think we counted all the steps, and if my memory again is right, there were 600 stone steps and then 300 wooden steps. I don't know what height it was, but it was a very great height. And we just got up the stone steps when we found an officer lying on the floor. He'd got vertigo and gone dizzy, and he couldn't stand up, and he couldn't go up, and he couldn't go down. So we left him there and told him to wait while we went right up to the top, had a look at the view, and then we came down, and we eventually pretty well carried him right the way down to the ground floor again. But he was absolutely helpless with the effect of the height he had had on him. But that was my last experience abroad.
But I'd been. Were you still a part of the 2nd First Fusiliers?
Well, I was sent home as that, you see. It was still on the 2nd First Fusiliers. But I remember one night there was a few others all coming. We were put on a boat down the Seine to go over to en route to Dover. And I still got my cap and my badges on of a fusiliers. But I had instructions to report to a place in South Kensington. Anyway, we crossed over to Dover, and was I glad to see the White Cliffs of Dover again. And then I went by train up to London, I forget which terminal it was, Waterloo I suppose, or somewhere like that, and then I had to find my way to this place in Kensington, South Kensington. There was a group of very large houses that had been taken over by the army, and I think it was for reorganising groups such as us and reallocating them to various duties. Anyway, they were just all empty rooms, and we had to sleep on the floor. I'm not sure whether there's any straw palliasses or not, but I know we slept on the floor, and it was a shocking place. And at night time, again, they took all our particulars, of course, and I think again they were waiting to allocate us to some other battalions. But in the meantime, we were sent to Waterloo each day, or Victoria, to load up mail bags for the troops on a train that was going to Dover. And I know on one night we were sent there to load up a train. and there was a terrific amount of mailbags going on this drain, and we had to throw them in and stack them up while the regular station staff just stood around taking the mickey out of us, not offering to help. Well, after about half hour of this, we got fed up with it, so we went on strike and refused to do any more. See? And in the end, there was a proper row about it, because the train had got to get away to time, so the station staff, regular station staff, had to do the job after all, and we were marched back to South Kensington.
Who were your other companions at South Kensington?
The companions who were in the group with us, they were a mixed lot from all sorts of various other various battalions, just all one or two men from this place, one or two from another battalion. There was no cohesion at all, but they were just oddments who'd been turned out for some reason or other, sickness or illness, or like me, bad eyesight or unfit. You see, there was no friendship and no friends amongst them. They were just strangers, really. But so we were sent back to these houses in South Kensington, and we were allocated then to all sorts of various places. And I know that I was allocated to the 100th Provisional Battalion on the east coast at Aldborough, near Saxmundham. This battalion was stationed on the coast for the defence of the east coast, and it was made up of men who hadn't signed for foreign service, because it wasn't compulsory then to sign for foreign service, and unless you signed for foreign service, they couldn't send you abroad. And
this was all before conscription.
Conscription had not come in then, no. And these chaps, they'd join up, but would refuse to sign for foreign service, and they'd made up this 100th Provisional Battalion, and they were stationed here at Aldborough. And I got posted to this lot. And I think then, I think I was about the only one who'd seen any service overseas. And because of that, these other chaps didn't like it, because you were given some preference, having been a man overseas. And of course I've been wounded, so I've got a wound stripe up, and I've got three long service chevrons. And so
where had you been wounded?
I was wounded on I think we got that when I was hit with the shot on Suvla Bay, remember? Well, I was wounded in the back of the neck, nothing serious, but never enough to be in the casualty list. I was a very lucky escape. I think I've given you that.
And you wore a stripe to say you
could. You wear a gold stripe, wound stripe. Yeah. And then you, for every 2 years service, you had a chevron on your arm like that. You see, like a corporal stripe, but upside down on your arm. And that, I'd done 6 years service, because my Quebec service counted as well. So I'd got three chevrons. I was quite an old soldier. But
what preferential treatment were you given?
Well, I said you were treated with, what should I say, some respect. And they liked to hear your stories and the tales you could tell of service, you see, and we went in the canteens. But the job out there, we were billeted at Aldborough. The town had been evacuated, cleared out really, and I don't think there was any civilians left there, and all the houses had been taken over by the military. And the job was to guard the east coast from an invasion. But the beach was all shingle, so there was no question of digging dugouts or anything of that. All we could do was to put sandbags and things, or bags filled with shingle, all round the houses that we were billeted in. Again, we had to sleep on the floors. One house would be used as a cookhouse, and when your food, you used to take a Dixie there and get a big pile of stew or something. I think it was nearly all stew, and cart it back to the place where your house where you lived, and have tins of stew pass round to you. But of course there were some places not far away, and I believe there was a sort of canteen where you could go and buy some stuff as well. And if there was any local inhabitants not far away, they would also look after you and give you some stuff. But every night, it was Aldeburgh was right in direct line with the German coastline, where the Zeppelins used to come across, and they used to come across from Germany and cross right over Aldeburgh. So every night the alarm would go, and we would all have to turn out. Not that we could do anything, because we hadn't got any artillery. There were some batteries nearby, but these Zeps would come over and go right over Aldeburgh, and the searchlights were picking them out, but the guns used to fire away at them, but they never hit them. And they used to go inland, and they caused quite a lot of damage with the bombs that they dropped, but nothing like in the last blitz, of course. But the geese in the local farms used to give us the earliest warning. They'd start kicking up hell's delight hours before before the regular warning would come through that the Zeps were coming over. But
what was the fear of invasion?
Well, they thought the Germans were going to invade, of course, but they never did. But
what were you told to do?
Well, we were supposed to repel them. We were supposed to. I believe we had to fall back for about. We were instructed to fall back for about 2 miles, where there were some lines of defence dug farther back, nearer to Saxmundham and places like that. But we couldn't have done much of put up much defence there, in any case. But
what weapons did you have?
We only had ordinary Lee-Enfield rifles, and I suppose there was a machine gun section of the battalion. I suppose there was. I don't know. But they were a bobby old lot anyway. They wouldn't have been much good in any attack. Some of them didn't know which end of the rifle the bullet came out. I think. But anyhow, somebody decided that it would be a good idea to have wooden frames made and sink into the shingle, and then pile the shingle round them to make dugouts, because there was no possibility of digging a dugout, because as you took one shovelful out, two shovelfuls fell in. So one morning there was a call for carpenters. The idea was they were going on to a big estate near Saxmundham, and the idea was that they were going to cut trees down on this big estate and make dugout frames, and they wanted so many carpenters. Well, I was very friendly with the sergeant there, and he was a carpenter in civil life. So he said to me, he says, "You don't like it here, do you?" I said, "No, I don't." "Well, don't." He says, "Well, you're a carpenter, aren't you?" He said, "You can do carpentry." I said, "I'm not a carpenter." So he said, "Well, you can do carpentry, can't you?" I said, "Well, yeah, I used to do it at school. I was very good at it." He says, "Well, say you're a carpenter." He said, "Go to the orderly room and give your name in." He said, "We want about 12 carpenters." So he said, "I'll see you through." So I went there, put my name down, and I got the job as a carpenter. And we were eventually posted, 12 of us, to this big estate at Saxmundham. Can't remember the name of the estate, but it was a wonderful place. And we were housed in tents. I think there was 4 tents and the 12 of us. And there was a man with an engine and a sawmill, and it was a couple of tree fellers, and it was their job to cut the trees down. And they were sawn up into planks by this sawmill, and then we had to saw the they were made into planks, and we had to saw the planks up, and the sergeant used to mark them out with mortise and tennis joints, and we had to cut the joints out and the tenons, so that they could be, and they were all numbered, so that they could be taken up onto the East Coast and erected quite easily. Well, we worked there all through that summer. It was a gorgeous summer, and it was hard work. We worked from 7 o'clock in the morning till dark, cutting up these logs and humping them about and loading up the wagons to be taken away. But it was enjoyable work, and I put on a lot of weight. I went up to well over 11 stone, I think,